Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There are a number of moving parts today in the conflict between Georgia and Russia. The tenuous ceasefire brokered by France does not seem like it's holding. At least five explosions have been heard in the city of Gori, and there are conflicting reports about what the Russian troops are doing and what their movements are today. On the face of it, the crisis in Georgia is a dispute between that nation and Russia. But the underlying tensions point to a power struggle between Russia and the United States. President Bush has dispatched Condoleezza Rice overseas, and American troops are now distributing humanitarian aid in Georgia. I'm Alice Rhee in for Brian Lehrer. And with me now is James Traub, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and the author of Devil's Playground, A Century of Pleasure and Profit in Times Square. Also with me, Michael Elliott, editor of Time International. And I should note that the Georgian crisis is on the cover of the magazine, and that hits newsstands tomorrow. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning.
So, Michael, let's begin with you. What is the latest? What is the status of this ceasefire, if we can still call it that?
Well, it's very unclear, actually. If you track news reports that are coming out of Tbilisi and elsewhere in the region in the last few hours, there've been some reports that Russians are just blowing up unexploded ordnance in the town of Gori, no more than that, and that they are moving out. And then there are other reports that they're digging in, not just in Gori, but in a Black Sea port of Georgia and elsewhere. So I think the situation is about as clear as mud at the moment. I would expect that over the next day or so, I don't know whether I'm being ludicrously optimistic, that a degree of stability does establish itself, and that we get some kind of clear visibility of those areas where the Russians intend to stay and those where they don't.
James, I want to bring you in. Let's go over the language of that ceasefire agreement brokered by the French president, Sarkozy. There was a problematic spot in there that the Georgians claim left things ambiguous, dangerously ambiguous, for them. Do you agree?
Yes, well, the general pattern here is that Russia is going to do what it wants to do, and then we'll find a rationale to explain why it did what it did.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened with that ceasefire agreement is the Russians insisted on a clause, which the Georgians didn't want, and President Sarkozy clearly didn't want, which stipulated that the Russian troops that had entered Georgia were there as peacekeepers, as part of Russia's peacekeeping role, and were essentially free to do what they thought they needed to do in their peacekeeping role. This then provided the pretext for the Russians to continue consolidating their hold on this city of Gori, as well as Poti and several villages in the surrounding areas, which they said, with what strikes me as consummate cynicism, they were doing in order to protect Georgian citizens, for example, in the case of Gori, Georgian citizens from reprisals by South Ossetians. I'm not even sure the Russians care if anybody believes them, but that certainly gave them their rationale.
So the ceasefire agreement, what was actually agreed to, was that they would keep the positions, correct?
Well, no. The complexity here is this, that one of the terms, the most important term of the agreement, was that both sides would return to the status quo ante as of last Thursday. But contradicting that, it turns out, was this other term which allowed the Russians already in Georgia to not have to return to their positions as of last week if they felt that in order to satisfy their peacekeeping role, they had to continue remaining in Georgia and indeed to go deeper into Georgia.
James is absolutely right. I mean, it's a bit of a back of the envelope peace accord, it must be said. The New York Times helpfully has a photograph of the French text today, and it's first of all, it's incredibly short. I mean, it's really just five sentences or so, each one of which is amenable to more than one interpretation.
I want to give our listeners a chance to weigh in, and we do have some exciting news. We are going back to the old number. It's 212-433-9692. Again, to our listeners, it's 212-433-9692. Please feel free to weigh in and ask questions on this conflict between Russia and Georgia. James, the issue of Condoleezza Rice now going overseas and to Georgia, and nothing on her itinerary that looks like she'll be in Moscow at any time. What is she trying to achieve there?
Well, it's mostly showing the flag. This is, everything has to be understood as a statement made towards Russia, as well as a statement made towards Georgia about our relationship with them and our unwillingness to accept Russian hostilities. The same clearly is true of this humanitarian effort. Now, we have agreed that we will be sending supplies to Georgia, accompanied by American military officials. Now, the supplies right now are fairly minimal. As of today, there seem to be two Air Force planes going over there. President Bush spoke of naval ships as well, but I'm not sure that actually is correct. But this is symbolically a big deal, not so much Rice going there, but having American supplies escorted by American military officials. It's not clear to me if those officials will be accompanying the supplies as they move out of Tbilisi towards these areas that are now being defended by the Russians. In other words, does that mean that American soldiers are going to be in proximity of Russian soldiers while escorting those supplies? If so, I mean, you could easily write a kind of nightmare scenario from that, but it's an important statement that the Bush administration is making.
So, Michael, how much of this is really a proxy conflict between the U.S. and Russia? What's at stake here for American foreign policy?
Well, obviously, there is, to an extent, a proxy contest. I'm not sure the contest is kind of quite the phrase. I mean, plainly, Russia's geostrategic position has changed quite dramatically in the last 5 or 6 years as its economy has picked up on the back of oil and other commodity prices. It's better organized diplomatically and militarily than it was 5 or 6, 7 years ago. It has a clearer perception and a clear execution, if you like, of its national interest than it had 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. And we've seen a number of times that it's going to bump up against the U.S.'s friends and allies in the region. And I think, to an extent, this is just, you know, part of the new world and something that we're going to have to get used to. I think what we've discovered in the last year or so, you know, to the shock of some people but not others, is that history doesn't always move in one direction, and that the idea that was so, you know, comforting 20 years ago, that the collapse of Soviet communism was going to lead to the development of something like Western liberal democracy in pretty short order, is now exposed for the naivety that I guess some of us always thought it was.
But I wonder if I could add something to what Michael said, which I think is absolutely right. The rise of non-democratic liberal states has quite different effects. And so the rise of China doesn't at all have the same effect as the rise of Russia.
Here, too, is an
authoritarian state which has grown very rapidly. And yet the kind of turbulence that has accompanied Russia's growth along Russia's borders is not true in the case of China. And the reason for that is that China defines the meaning of its growth and its place in the world in a very different way from the way that Russia does. And China, therefore, strikes one as being a country that is much more adapted to the globalized world we live in, where things like territorial control don't matter the way they used to. Russia feels much more like it is behaving like a 19th century regional power, and doing so poses very different problems for the world than does, for example, the rise of China, or for that matter, of India, Brazil, and other new powers.
I think that's an enormously acute and sharp point, and really does explain why Russia is a different case, as James says, from the other powers.
Well, I'd like to have you both listen to President Bush yesterday making comments, what really seemed quite to be a warning to Russia. Let's take a listen.
Recent years, Russia has sought to integrate into the diplomatic, political, economic, and security structures of the 21st century. The United States has supported those efforts. Now Russia is putting its aspirations at risk by taking actions in Georgia that are inconsistent with the principles of those institutions.
So, James, just to have you follow up on your point,
yeah.
What can Russia gain or lose?
Well, let me just go back to the historical point that Bush was making. In the 1990s, Russia did indeed aspire, just as Bush said he did, to join the West. But the fact is, from Russia's own point of view, that was a period of utter failure. And so Russia now associates its much greater sense of success with a completely different posture and thinks of the West, so far as I can tell, as hostile to its interests. There's a deep kind of zero-sum sense that governs Russian foreign policy in the Putin era that is the opposite of that integrationist mentality that President Bush was talking about. So, you know, if Russia now sees its own interests in much more classical zero-sum terms, that is to say, that we have to gain control over our near abroad, over our other territory, even if the rest of the world doesn't like it. I think the question that this is going to start raising constantly is, on the part of the West, how much of this can be permitted? On the part of Russia, what costs are they willing to incur in order to pursue what strikes me, as I say, as a kind of archaic sense of how a great power self-interest is measured?
Michael, do you agree? Also, what does Russia stand to gain or lose here?
I agree entirely with James' analysis. I must say, I agree with every word of it. I mean, what does Russia stand to gain or lose? I don't myself think that the United States and its friends in Europe can inflict an enormous amount of pain on Russia right now. I suppose everyone could decide to expel Russia from the G8 group of leading industrial nations. I don't think that'll happen, incidentally, but I suppose that could possibly be contemplated. Russia has said that it wants to join the World Trade Organization. I suppose that could be put on hold. But these don't honestly seem to me to be very, very serious sanctions. And they're just ideas, in any event, that Washington on its own cannot make happen. I think the broader point is living with this, as James rightly says, kind of slightly archaic neo-imperial set of policies that Moscow seems to have adopted, and kind of finding ways over the long term to soothe them and to make them understand that there is a better way of integrating themselves into the security and economic structures of the 21st century. If you think right back to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, I mean, I can remember this very, very well. I was a Washington correspondent at the time, and the administration of George H.W. Bush, Brent Scowcroft and others were very concerned that they should not rub Russia's nose in its own failure. I mean, it was something that was much discussed at the highest levels of administration. And I think myself, we slightly lost the focus of that policy around the mid-1990s, though I have to say for very good reasons or for very understandable reasons. But I think we're going to have to kind of get back into a way in which over a period of years we try as far as we can to nudge, to use that overused word of 2008, Russia into a system where it into a position where it advances its interests without this saber-rattling neo-imperial style that it's adopted in the last couple of weeks.
But I think the tough question that's going to raise, because I think Michael's absolutely right that there's a limited number of things we can do, is, does this conflict mean that we have to abandon the idea, and Georgia has to abandon the idea, of gaining membership in NATO, Georgia and Ukraine, because that's too confrontational? Or does it mean the exact opposite? Does it mean the exact opposite, that we need to say to Russia, we will not allow you to unilaterally define the rules of the security architecture that we have seen evolving over time, and therefore, if anything, we will advance Georgia and Ukraine's aspiration to join NATO? I think this is going to be a key question, and there's going to be sharp disagreements about it.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, I'd like to thank you both, James Traub, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and the author of Devil's Playground. Also, Michael Elliott, editor of Time International. And again, the Georgian crisis is on the cover of the magazine that hits newsstands tomorrow. Thank you both.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Thank you. Okay.